everyone, and welcome to another episode of Pulse. This week, we're going to be bringing attention to a very special month. This month is actually special for a few different reasons, as you'll see from our two different episodes. This month is both Mental Health Awareness Month and Drug Court Awareness Month. So this month, we'll be taking time to highlight both of these areas that have so many ties to the criminal legal system, but also are just independently important. So with that, I will go ahead and introduce who I have with me today. As always, my co-host, Michael.
Hey, everybody. Excited to be here.
And this week, we're really excited to have with us Judge Stoner of the Drug Court here in Oklahoma, if you wouldn't mind saying a few words.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's always best to start off with some humor whenever you're talking to a group. And I was addressing Leadership Oklahoma a couple months ago. I was really trying to think of something funny to say. My wife said I should skip it because I'm not very funny, which I thought, well, that's not true. People laugh at my jokes all the time. And she said, bless your heart, you know people laugh because you're the judge, right? And I did notice that once I became a judge, I did get a lot funnier. I realized that because everybody laughs at my jokes. But she said, just tell everybody your name is Judge Stoner. You're in charge of drug court. That's plenty funny. So that's my introduction area.
Well, welcome. We're truly so lucky to have you here with us today to detail what drug court's about. Before we get into all that, I'd like to know, how did your legal career lead you to drug court? How did you get interested in this kind of subsection here?
I became a judge. I've been around the courthouse in Oklahoma County for over 20 years. I started my career as a prosecutor in the DA's office. I was there for about 5.5 years. And then I left and went in private practice. And I mostly, at the time when I left private practice, I did corporate work. And I've got very involved in corporate securities, corporate compliance. And over a period of time, I ended up kind of going back into criminal defense work with a kind of an emphasis on representing people with addiction and mental health issues. Kind of became kind of innovative around that area. I think one of the benefits I had was leaving the courthouse and kind of going away. And when I came back, I was able to kind of put more fresh eyes on it and ask more questions like, why do we do what we do? And is this really working? And having some experience in the business corporate world, you know, you measure outcomes, you look at data, you track what's working and what's not by measurements. And so I started thinking about some of our problems more maybe holistic or like on a bigger scale and asking the questions, why do we do what we do? And I kind of created a kind of an innovative practice around in private practice, helping people with addiction and mental health issues and making it not just the legal issue, but I partnered with a therapist who actually moved into my office, and every case we took a very holistic approach to it and realized really what the justice system wants is healthy people. I wouldn't just help someone with a legal issue. We'd also work on them being healthy and have a therapeutic path to recovery. And I guess through that, I just became really fascinated and interested with addiction and the brain and behavior change and how it all works. I ended up leading to my appointment by the governor to become a district judge in Oklahoma County. I actually sought the position as a district judge to really do this type of work. You know, it's important for us to have an excellent drug court, to have, you know, be among the best, which I thought was really important because as leaders, we're responsible for the framework and the structures that we have. And fortunately, I was appointed as a district judge. And over the past 4.5 years, we've made a lot of positive changes. I'm really pleased to say we have a very successful program. There's over 4,000 drug courts in the United States. There's 56 drug courts in the state of Oklahoma. Nationally, drug courts have a graduation rate of 60%. In Oklahoma, our graduation rate's around 67%, but in Oklahoma County, we have an 83% graduation rate. That means 4 to 5 people that come in these programs graduate, get their charges dismissed, really set them on a path to recovery, stable jobs, stable housing. It's very rewarding to watch them flourish.
That's absolutely incredible. Those numbers are fantastic. I saw that they were highlighted as well in a recent Tulsa World article that I encourage people to go look at. That again highlights your program. It's proven to save lives, save money, reduce crime. These courts treat substance use disorders. therefore allowing people to break the cycle of addiction in families, treat mental health needs as well, reduce rearrests and reincarcerations, deliver services for lifelong recovery, and reduce substance use and overdose, which therefore allows them to live, to secure education, employment, and housing, and it even reduces emergency room admissions as well. There's so many avenues we could look at this in, and the results of 7 meta-analyses of drug courts, accounting of over 350 individual drug courts, found that recidivism to drop, regardless of how it is measured, whether arrest, future drug use, or reconviction, by a maximum of 26% and a minimum of 8%. So regardless of drug court and the measure of recidivism, drug courts have proven very effective. Maybe not quite for every single participant, but they're still overall very effective.
You know, the number one and two reasons that people fail drug court in Oklahoma County is they just keep running away. They just really won't work the program. They just keep going AWOL and they won't ever do it. Or they commit new crimes in the program. And unfortunately that happens sometimes too. We'll have some in the program and they commit a new crime in the middle of the program. And and occasionally we can work with that, but sometimes it just does not work out and they end up being revoked. So, but everybody else that shows up and keeps working on it, we keep working with them. And I always tell people that, change isn't just possible. It's actually probable and predictable if you have the right path, the right framework for people to be successful. If you give them the right amount of encouragement, support, accountability, bring them into an evidence-based process, manage it by a set of principles, it works. Treatment works. It's really saved us a bunch of money on a statewide level. Plus, it's just the right thing to do. We care about our citizens of our community.
I was really shocked to see when I was doing some research for this episode that according to the 2020 National Survey on Drug Use and Health, approximately 41 million people aged 12 and older needed substance use treatment in 2019 alone. The survey also revealed that 1.6 million adolescents that were aged from 12 to 17 had a substance use disorder, and 644,000 of those youth had a co-occurring major depressive episode in 2019. So, on one hand, I was really shocked truly by how young that is. 12 years old, that is so young. But on the other hand, I was also just shocked by the sheer number. That's a lot of people, 41 million people.
To me, it's staggering. It's absolutely staggering. Our Surgeon General of the United States in 2016 did the first ever Surgeon General report on addiction. And by any way you want to measure it, it is the public health crisis of our time. And I even would put it next to COVID in terms of impact that it has. The New York Times did an article a year ago that was comparing COVID deaths related to just drug overdose deaths. So this is just talking about deaths. This is not just people who are addicted. These are the people that die from overdoses from addiction, which is actually a pretty small category of people. But if you were to look at the number of overdose deaths, and instead of just looking at the number of deaths, but look at the years of life lost. So if you look at the years of life lost to COVID, if your average person that's getting a dying of COVID are in their 70s and life expectancy is 78 years old, you might have a loss of life for 6 years. And of course, that is tragic. Most of the people that are dying of drug overdoses, are in their 20s, and years of life lost it's in the ballpark with COVID. It's still less than COVID. It really is a public health crisis of the overdose deaths, the number of people with addiction. In some ways, it is staggering, but when you realize that every major sporting event is sponsored by an alcohol company, and alcohol is certainly such an embedded part of our culture, it's really not that far of a step. Of course, now cannabis is kind of leaning in that direction, and as far as being much more widely accepted, and then of course in harder drugs, people, we all know the story of the opioids, where opioid manufacturers have been really aggressively marketing opioids for pain management. Most people do use them as prescribed, but there's a certain population that does not. It's kind of set us on this trajectory of, substances are a lot of times a solution to pain, whether it's alcohol, whether it's opioids, whether it's cannabis, or even some of these other harder drugs, heroin, methamphetamine. In some ways, when you look at what causes addiction, not just use, but there are some people that can use substances, but those that become addicted, you'll always find those that are addicted. And I use the word addicted in the way that you have continued use despite harm. You have cravings, compulsions, and continued use despite harm. I'm still using this, even though it's harmful to me. If you're doing that, there's a reason for it. And the reason for it is that your brain is different than others' brains. I mean, you can always trace it back to exposure to childhood trauma, people that are self-medicating the symptoms of mental illness, learned use, which actually happens whenever children start, you have a developing brain, someone starts using at 13, 14, 15 years old, kind of hardwires the brain into addictive patterns, and you have genetic factors are huge. Addiction susceptibility is more inheritable than breast cancer. 50% of risk of addiction comes from genetic factors. And just to be clear, genetics don't cause addiction, but they cause a susceptibility to it. So the way your body metabolizes that substance, it spikes your dopamine higher and more quickly than maybe somebody else. That's because your genetics and the way your body metabolizes that substance, it anchors the addictive pathways.
That's so interesting, especially because I feel like people with substance use disorders are so stigmatized, you know? I mean, it's so interesting that, like you said, we never go into the behavior behind it, the reasoning behind it, the true why.
People would say, well, I can stop drinking, therefore you should be able to stop drinking. That's almost like saying, well, I'm not lactose intolerant, therefore you shouldn't be lactose intolerant. I can eat peanuts, therefore you should be able to eat peanuts. There are some people that their addiction comes from their use and the way their body metabolizes a substance that other people use responsibly. And so we got to approach these problems from a sense of more, I call it moral humility, instead of judging, they should just stop. Maybe they should stop. But believe me, once you start using and it's causing you harm, if they could, they would. They can't. And it's because they're addicted. It's a disorder, a disease, however you want to classify it. And they need help. They need treatment. Part of the puzzle, though, is that one of the hallmarks of addiction is that there's also a lot of denial around it. So people don't always recognize that they're addicted, or they actually don't want to stop. There's part of their brain that wants to stop and part of their brain that doesn't want to stop. And there's this constant tug of war between, the more addictive pathways and your prefrontal cortex that does executive function. There's this tug of war there, and they need treatment. That's where the evolution of drug courts started.
So the history behind drug court is actually just as interesting as drug court today. When I was doing research, I actually found two different conflicting claims of where the first drug court was ever invented. So one says the first jurisdiction to implement a drug court was in New York City, and it says that it created the court in 1974 in response to the enforcement of the draconian Rockefeller drug laws, which overwhelmed the state's criminal justice system with an unrelenting spate of drug cases throughout the 1970s. But another report says that the drug courts actually came from movements beginning in the 1980s that was in growing response to drug-related court cases, and that they had found that traditional law enforcement and correction policies alone weren't having the impact on the drug supply and demand, basically, that the proponents of the war against drugs and war on drugs had hoped. Therefore, they say as a result, in the summer of 1989, an administrative order from Chief Judge of Florida's 11th Judicial Circuit set the first drug court in motion. So while these differ, we do know that in 1994, federal legislation was enacted to support the growing local and state interest in drug courts, and the Violent Crime Control and the Law Enforcement Act authorized support for local and state drug courts as well. But there's so much more we could dive into here, especially with the war on drugs and on the opioid crisis. I mean, both of these have led to an increase in individuals who have a cross-section between substance use, substance disorders, and the criminal legal system. I mean, just off the basis, just right off the top of my head, that almost everyone knows is the disparity between crack and cocaine, and how that also had a huge impact on the racial components of mass incarceration.
Yeah, back on the crack cocaine issue, I was a prosecutor back when that was going on. I mean, I wasn't on the federal side, I was on the state side. But I can tell you that at least from my perspective, this really aggressive law enforcement approach, in hindsight, it just seems just pretty medieval and bizarre. But at the time, it was really well-intentioned. I mean, it's like, you know, there were really people that were highly addicted to crack cocaine. It was far more addictive. And that's because of the way your body metabolizes crack cocaine. It spikes your dopamine more quickly and higher than regular cocaine. Yes, there was a higher percentage of people using that in the, we'll say it more, you know, impoverished, disadvantaged groups. You know, it's like if the only tool you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. But that certainly has led to credible disparities that, you know, I think looking back on it, that, you know, anybody that was making those decisions at the time should be embarrassed. But it did come from a place of, you know, how do we try to, you know, what should the government do to try to stop this? We've learned more about addiction in the last decade than we had probably all of, you know, history combined, about, you know, the part of the brain that calculates the future consequences of current behavior. That's actually the part of the brain that doesn't work when you're in addiction. So increasing criminal punishment to an addicted population, they don't register that. They can't calculate what's going to happen if I do this, because that's the part of their brain that's offline whenever they're wrapped in addiction. Kind of go higher level than that now. Let's say property crimes, for example, nationally committed substance use, abuse, or addiction is a relevant factor in 78% of all property crimes. Personally, I did a survey in Oklahoma County among judges and lawyers that work in our criminal justice system. They reported that, in their opinion, about 75% of all criminal cases, substance use, abuse, or addiction is a relevant factor. We know that about half of divorces and guardianships, substance use, abuse, or addiction is a relevant factor. We also know that 83% of children, this is not from a survey, this is Department of Human Services data, 83% of children that go into protective custody, one of the allegations is the home is unfit due to substance use, abuse, and addiction. And yet, despite the fact that this is a dominant theme in criminal justice, my view is that we've really not paid close attention to what's really driving the behavior and what fixes the behavior, the addiction. So, you know, for example, you know, prosecutors, I used to be one, they don't receive a lot of training. When I say a lot, I mean, there's zero classes in law school about it. There's only a handful of continuing education classes around addiction. Generally, those are just people that are in specialty courts, professionals that work in treatment courts like myself. The vast majority of continuing education or legal education for lawyers is around everything from how do you get evidence in the, you know, how do you get a piece of evidence in, or, you know, trial techniques or different ways to make closing arguments. And there's really not a lot of education for judges, lawyers, that's both on both sides, defense attorneys and prosecutors, around what's really driving the criminal behavior. We've been kind of the epicenter of the incarceration crisis globally. We got more people incarcerated, you know, per capita than, you know, almost any other place in the civilized world. We've got to take this more seriously. If you took everybody who's in prison in Oklahoma and we just let half of them go, we would still be ahead of 21 other states in terms of incarceration per capita. That's just really expensive. It's really inefficient. And, you know, 93% of people who go to prison come back to live with us in our community. And I'm telling you, if they were addicted before they went in, they're going to be addicted when they get out. Addiction does not, I mean, incarceration does not cure addiction. If you're diabetic before you go to prison, you'll be diabetic when you get out. Yeah. If you're schizophrenic before you go to prison, you'll be schizophrenic when you get out. I'm here to tell you, if you have an addiction when you go to prison, you'll have addiction when you get out, unless you have access to meaningful treatment.
I was just going to ask, for people who are listening to this, who aren't aware, can you just explain like what drug court is and how it operates?
Yeah. So drug court, if you have what we call criminogenic history, that means you've had multiple interactions with the criminal justice system and not done well. You failed probation. It's time for you to go to prison. But you also have been identified as someone who has a moderate to severe substance use disorder, and you have a motivation you want to change. You really are interested in doing something different. If you meet that criteria, you can come into a treatment court, and it's a very highly structured program that's just focused around treatment and behavior change. It is considered the highest level of supervision in all the criminal justice system. So people that come in, they have 10 random UAs a month. I mean, that's a lot of UAs. So it means about basically every 3 days, you've got another UA. If you're not maintaining your sobriety or you miss UA, we use incentives and sanctions to help you follow the guidelines of the program. So if you're not following the guidelines of the program, you get some kind of a sanction. Now, it's an evidence-based model. Sanctions could be as low as writing a paper or having a curfew. Might be something what we call in-court detention or in-court observation, where people have to come and just sit and watch court. That's probably our most common sanction. Community service, and we have a type of structured community service in Oklahoma County where people work on a work crew. It's called SHINE. It's a great program committed by our county commissioner, Brian Maughan. And then we have, of course, jail sanctions, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5-day jail sanctions. So our maximum jail sanctions, 5 days. The science is really clear on incarceration. It can be really effective on a short-term basis, 1 or 2 days, to kind of get someone's attention, to get them reset, get them refocused on their program of recovery. Whereas longer jail sanctions, it causes them to be destabilized around employment, housing, childcare, things like that. So we want to get them back in the community, keep them engaged in treatment rather than doing a jail sanction. The average person stays in drug court 18 to 24 months. You can graduate the program in 18 months. Most people take about 2 years to get through the program. There's phases. So, you know, there's 4 phases the way we do it in Oklahoma County. We have 4 phases that are treatment phases. And to graduate to the next phase, you have to meet certain treatment milestones and certain numbers of sober days to advance in the program. And then the last 6 months of the program is called aftercare. And all you're doing is just demonstrating that you can maintain your sobriety. You're just monitored. And then you graduate. When you graduate, your charges are dismissed. I can't say that's not in every county in Oklahoma does that, but the way that Oklahoma County does it, that we found to be most successful, is that carrot, that incentive for working so hard to, you know, change your life, is that your criminal charges are dismissed upon successful completion of the program. So you got a clean slate, or at least the cleanest slate you can possibly have, despite whatever past you might have before that, that helps you kind of launch into just a life of recovery and being a productive citizen and with your life restored. You know, and of course, if you fail the program, you go to prison, you go do your prison sentence, whatever you signed up for in the beginning. So whenever someone comes in, you know, they have what's called a delayed sentence. So we take their plea, they plead guilty, and we sit off they're sentenced until graduation. So at their graduation, their charges are dismissed, or if they end up being revoked from the program. So unfortunately, about a little bit less than 1 out of 5 people are revoked from the program and have to go do their prison sentence. All the professionals that work in there, from the district attorney's office to the defense attorney to the judge, the probation officer that does supervise the treatment team, our goal is problem solving, which is, you know, how do we help this person become sober? What is, and not just sober, but actually get into recovery, which is a little different. We can talk about that later, but give them this framework to keep them encouraged to engage in treatment, changing things they need to change their life to be healthy, changing their people, place, and things, getting safe, stable, sober housing, helping them find meaningful work, and solving transportation issues, and kind of looking at everybody's case uniquely and individually.
Yeah, when I was working in the drug court, one of the things that I was most struck with was how the adversarial nature kind of fell away, and you had all the actors in the courtroom working towards the same rehabilitative goal. Is that something that you've noticed, and can you speak to that a little bit?
Completely. Our goal is for the person to be, you know, healthy and thriving in recovery. And so generally, if there's disagreements, it's just around, you know, kind of the way different people might see. It's like we have in our program, we have peer support. These are people who have graduated the program and now they've come back and work for us, and they have that lived experience. And so they might chime in and say, hey, Judge, I think in this situation, you need to kind of pull back a little bit on a sanction, because they can identify with where they're at in their recovery and what they've changed. Or they might say, Judge, you need to be a little heavier this time, because I know where they're at and they're really not taking this as seriously. You need to have a heavier sanction, a heavier hand. And so the team really has a conversation around, you know, all these, we'll say, competing interests. And we do a lot of what we call staffing, which is we talk about everybody every week in the program, where they're at, what their drug tests are, how they're engaging in treatment. I mean, like I said, everybody on the team, from the prosecutor, the judge, the probation officer, we want people to be healthy in recovery, and we're trying to identify what those barriers are and removing the barriers, or giving the right amount of support, encouragement, and the right amount of accountability to help them get well. the way we look at it, like every person is a little bit of a puzzle, and some of them are more difficult than others. And if that person ends up failing the program, it's our fault. Like we think about it in terms of, you know, maybe there was a skill that we didn't quite develop to be able to engage this type of high-risk person. Maybe we weren't communicating them in a way that we were as culturally competent as we should be. And so we really think about, you know, it's really easy to say when people fell out, like, well, they didn't want it, or that's their fault because it was there and they just didn't want to do it. Well, yes and no. I mean, who really wants to be in addiction? Who really wants to be going to prison? I mean, they don't really want to suffer. And so, you know, each of the team members, we really feel like it's our goal and responsibility to be as skilled as possible to try to meet someone where they're at and help them lead them out of addiction. So whether it's through just relationships, the way that we communicate, the way that we supervise, we're trying to always build trust. Everybody's always treated with dignity and respect, regardless of, you know, what they've done. I mean, even if they're messing up in the program, you know, we still treat them with dignity and respect. You treat people how you aspire them to become. And frankly, this ought to be across the board. Anybody that's engaged in, if you're a public safety professional, whether you're a law enforcement agent or a judge or anybody, or a prosecutor that you work in public safety, there's really no excuse for treating people poorly, even people that have committed crimes. First of all, I'd say how you treat someone says a lot more about you than it does about them. But also part of it is just cultivating a trust in the system that, you know, you're always treated fairly. And even if, you know, you have, you know, a sanction or something doesn't go your way, you understand why, and you're still treated with respect and a wish for you to get better. And even if you're those kind of people who say, look, I don't know, the criminals, I don't, you know, treating them well, you know, I just want to live in a safe community and I want to be efficient here, save bunch of money. It's like, well, that's part of the formula. If you want to save money, we've got to, incarceration is very expensive. It tends not to be nearly as effective as a treatment court model. And if you want people to become law-abiding citizens, you know, you've got to give them the framework in which for them to be successful. And that's just part of it. And, you know, it turns out by helping others is helps ourselves. You know, we end up having a safer community and saving a bunch of money.
When speaking in terms of numbers, it also reminds me in 2019 of the Johnson & Johnson case here in Oklahoma. And it's especially prevalent because in November of 2021, Oklahoma's highest court, or Oklahoma Supreme Court, threw out the 2019 ruling that required Johnson & Johnson to pay the state $465 million for its role in the opioid epidemic. It was basically the original case stated that Johnson & Johnson had purposefully created an increase in opioid use and distribution in Oklahoma, and that therefore Oklahoma would need to fix this issue over the next 20 years. And that's what that money was supposed to go to. It was supposed to go to increased drug court, increased addiction treatment. It was basically supposed to put the pieces back together for Oklahoma for the next 20 years due to the opioid crisis. And so I'm wondering, in terms of money, is this something that it's in appeals right now, of course, and so this is something we never know that whether or not it'll come to Oklahoma, but is this something that you saw and something that you think is beneficial to Oklahoma and where we're moving?
No, great question. It's just on average, drug court cost about $5,000 a year to have somebody in a drug court. If you're in a mental health court, it's about $5,500 a year. Incarceration, there were some new calculations in the last year. It's about $24,000 a year to have someone incarcerated. Okay, so you got a program, it's about $5,000 a year. You get better outcomes and lower recidivism as opposed to someone who goes to prison. Their recidivism rate, I mean, they're more likely to come back in the system. It's almost four or five times as much. It's what I call a one question IQ test. You know, okay, this works better. It's less expensive. What should we be doing more of? You know, making sure that everybody, and by the way, this is one of the things that, you know, sometimes when I go make remarks to groups, people roll their eyes and they go, especially those that are, some people use the word reform. I was talking to Trish Everest, our commissioner of public safety. She said she started using the word criminal justice modernization, just coming up to modern practices. And so reform, modernization, whatever you want to call it. Some people roll their eyes and go, okay, Judge, yeah, I know everybody needs to be in drug court. Everybody needs to be in drug court. Like, well, no, that's actually not true. There's, I don't believe that everybody should be in drug court. I just think that everybody that should be in drug court should be in drug court. That means if you meet the statutory criteria, you're not a violent offender, and you have a moderate to severe substance use disorder, and you want help and treatment, every one of those people should be in treatment courts. And they're not. And there's a lot of reasons why they're not. It would save us a bunch of money. Most of the funding for the treatment comes from the departmental health. And so they get funding to pay for the treatment while people are in our program. So all of our treatment providers that we partner with have a contract with departmental health to bill for the treatment services for those individuals. But we also have a partnership with the Department of Corrections, and they supply two or three probation officers that are assigned to our program because, you know, people that they're able to supervise here to keep them out of prison keeps them off their caseload down the road. We have a partnership with the DA's office, the PD's office. We also get some federal grants. As a matter of fact, we're working on a federal grant right now to support the program. I was watching the opioid litigation and also, you know, the state question 780, 781, which is all the savings on incarceration was supposed to be filtered into treatment. Both of that has still yet to mature. You know, the opioid money, OSU was to be recipient of huge portions of that to focus around research around addiction treatment, which is needed. But I don't think any of it really, none of us made its way to my MarCourt program. Now we've got a couple of technology grants from DMH. We've actually been getting a little bit of public support where we've started the Community Foundation of Oklahoma has opened a nonprofit account. So if the public wants to make a contribution, support treatment efforts or really some of our incentives or some of our training or you know, the operation of the program, transportation, housing, they can make a contribution through the Communities Foundation of Oklahoma and through the Oklahoma County Drug Court Fiscal Responsibility Fund. I am not soliciting donations as a judge. That's not my role is to ask people for a donation, but I feel like I can educate the community. If somebody does want to contribute, that's where you'd start to look at.
I do have one more question for you though. When I was looking at statistics, a survey of drug courts nationwide finds that white participants graduate drug court at a rate of 52.8%, while African Americans graduate at a rate of 36.2%. And the literature has attributed this difference to employment rates coming in, the drug of choice, and trust in counseling services. Given that your specific drug court has a much higher graduation rate than the national average, I was just wondering if you were cognizant that different groups have different needs or how you handle that kind of racial disparity.
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. We are embarking this summer on just a really detailed equity and inclusion analysis of our program, because we generally have an idea, but we don't track the data as closely as we should, or I think we could. And so we're actually embarking on a kind of an audit, I'll say, of our program internally in Oklahoma County, just to see exactly where they are and what adjustments we might need to make. There are factors that kind of play into some of this. I mean, we have team members that are Black, we have team members that are Latino, we have team members that are Native, Hispanic, and we really strive to be culturally competent. That means being able to kind of communicate with different groups in a way that they can relate to, they can connect with, and we work hard to pair some of our peer support in a way that people can relate to. First of all, I think we have a duty just to be aware of exactly where we are. So if there is a disparity, figure out why. I mean, what's going on there? And you know, are you engaging someone in a culturally competent manner? The type of language that you use, the image that you use, the way that, you know, some of the counseling or the groups that might work. I'll give an example here, Latino culture. You know, we've partnered with Latino Agency in Oklahoma City to help provide treatment to our Latino community. I mean, there's obviously the most issues that the language, you know, issues and some of the nuances in the language, in Spanish language is something I'm just not familiar with the nuances in the Spanish language, but sometimes this nuance and this connection, the relationship and the trust is built with this, making sure that you can communicate with somebody on a way that is culturally competent. But just something that's unique about Latino culture is that men specifically, man, they really have a difficult time asking for help. I mean, men in general, we're all kind of hard-headed and we don't like to help, ask for help anyway, men don't, but it's even more prevalent. It's more considered a sign of weakness in Latino culture, you know, for men to say, hey, I'm struggling right now. I'm really having difficulty. I need to build some more skills around coping mechanisms or how I'm going to deal with difficult emotions, which, you know, can trigger a relapse. We have to be really skilled. That's just one example of, you know, how it is that we, you know, communicate with these different populations. You look at your community, what's your racial makeup of your community? Then you look at your racial makeup of your jail population and what, you know, the number of people that are being charged. And then you look at your treatment court. Are they coming in at the same rate that they're in the jail? And then how they're progressing. Are they graduating at the same rate? And making sure that if there's not, there's what's going on? Is there some kind of implicit bias that you just didn't recognize? You know, or is there some skill that we can develop to engage that particular population differently? Needs that are unique to that population that might be different that we can figure out how to meet them. And so that's the benefit of having a really professional drug court team when you're looking at, okay, well, how do we remove these obstacles, give someone the right level of support, and having a diverse, we'll say peer group or diverse experience where, you know, we have people from, you know, like on our team that really help provide really helpful insights on kind of where people are in their recovery and the types of things that they need to get better and heal, because they can help us from that more of a culturally competent position.
Do you have any closing thoughts to leave the listeners with?
Well, yeah, I mean, I got a couple things. I mean, the first thing I want to think about is that I being the epicenter of the incarceration crisis, it leaves us with a unique opportunity to be the epicenter of the solution. I think that we're making a lot of efforts and we're on the right track. I look forward to the day that, you know, 10 years from now that we can look back at Oklahoma and say, wow, man, we were really bad, you know, in terms of our incarceration rate. And, you know, 10 years from now, you know, we go from last to first in terms of having a healthier community, really becoming skilled. Instead of becoming known for our high incarceration rate, let's become known for the skill of our diversion programs. You know, that's something to be proud of. And we have really solid, well-functioning, efficient. I mean, for every dollar spent in drug courts, you get a $4 return, you know, on your investment. I mean, I don't know anybody out there who's got a, you know, 400% return on their IRA, but that is an incredible number. And we can look back, it's like, wow, we're saving a ton of money. We have a healthier community in our incarceration, and we're only really locking up those people that are really dangerous in a way that we couldn't change their, you know, behavior otherwise. We do have to approach these problems from a sense of, I heard it called once, moral humility. I mean, you gotta be patient and humble and look at the big picture. So if you look at just, you know, what somebody did on that police report, we'll look at the crime they committed. And it's really easy to get mad at them and frustrated with them. But if you have some moral humility, can step back and look at the bigger picture of, man, what is it that we're really trying to do here? What do we really care about? What are the tools that we have to help someone heal? And what, at the end of the day, what we really want is we want a healthy community. We want public safety. We want people to, you know, thrive. And how do you do that? And then, you know, is incarceration, does it get you where you want it to go? I mean, the truth is there are some people that are really dangerous and scary, and we just have to separate them from us because we just haven't yet figured out how to, you know, help them, you know, cure them from this, but, you know, their behavior issue. So that's number one. I am optimistic for our future. I think there's a lot of positive changes. And especially with things like in Oklahoma County, like the diversion hub is coming online and the modernization of some of our systems a decade from now, we can look back and go, man, we were, you know, among the worst and now we're among the best. And man, Oklahoma, we're really known for just the outstanding quality of our diversion programs. The other thing is on a note, this is kind of tangential to what we've been talking about today, but we are on the front end of a fentanyl crisis, and that could probably be a whole episode in and of itself, but we have to get the word out about fentanyl. Fentanyl is being pressed into pills that people buy on the street. They look like they come from reputable, look like they're prescription medication. They look identical to it, but they're not well mixed. Fentanyl is, I think our overdose deaths this year was over 100,000. Most of that's due to fentanyl. That's at people that don't intend to even be consuming fentanyl, and they are. They thought they bought some kind of an oxycodone or a Lortab or heroin laced with fentanyl or methamphetamine laced with fentanyl. I was actually on a panel with Mark Woodward, the director of Oakland Bureau of Narcotics, and he said they've intercepted pills that are fentanyl pills that are in the shape of Tylenol. They look like Tylenols. If you really understand what's going on in the fentanyl space, it's so cheap to produce. It is a great high. I mean, as far as, people, it makes you feel, it's a painkiller. So people that are in pain are more likely to use it. It might mean physical pain, emotional pain. It is killing a lot of people. And I'm afraid it's going to get worse before it gets better. So we've got to get education out there around fentanyl. Anything you buy off the street is, it's just like Russian roulette. You don't know what's in it, and you could die. Our deaths, our record deaths right now are almost twice what, I grew up in the 80s where AIDS was the public health crisis, and it dominated the media news for about a decade, the AIDS crisis. And, right now just our overdose deaths this last year have almost doubled what the peak of AIDS deaths were back in the 80s. And so it's a genuine crisis that we've all got to be getting the word out, talking to people about buying pills off the street. And there's pills or any other drugs, even cannabis is now laced with fentanyl. It's dangerous. So anyway, I just want to thank you guys for doing this and willingness to have the conversation. I really appreciate your efforts, to really focus on addiction in the criminal justice space. I think we've got to do as much as we can to educate the public that, funding these programs and supporting these programs and getting the right people in these programs make our community safer, makes our state healthier. And it's frankly, it's the right thing to do morally, helping people. If we have the ability to help them, we should, especially when it's cost effective and gets better outcomes. This should be a no-brainer. So thank you guys.
Thank you for spending time with us today and also for all the work you do, not only for the individual participants in drug court, but for Oklahoma County as a whole and the state as a whole. We really appreciate your work.
It's an honor for me to be able to serve. And it is, one of my friends said this, he said, this is not rocket science. It's just really, really hard work. and it is dealing with people's pain and suffering and change behavior on a one-on-one basis. It is a lot of work, but I'm honored to be able to do it. And hopefully we can continue to export some of the great stuff we're doing to some of these outlier communities that might be struggling or trying to figure out really how to get a good foothold on their treatment court.
Yeah, I'd like to echo what Mike said and thank you as well. When you were speaking about fentanyl and how it's just sweeping the nation, I did want to briefly touch on fentanyl test strips or FTS, which are just basically they're simple strips that do exactly as they sound like. You either put your pill in water or you mash it up and put it in a clean container, and then you use this strip to test whether there's any traces of fentanyl in the pill that you are going to take. And though we don't advocate for, of course, taking drugs, we do advocate for saving lives. In that vein, they're very cheap. We are across the nation, we're seeing that more and more companies are putting them into easy access places like bathrooms and gas stations, places like that. We understand that sometimes this resource is necessary for people. And if you are going to engage, we hope that you engage in a safe way and that we can work towards making them more accessible as well.
I'm really proud to say our Oklahoma County Treatment Court, we're actually have a pilot program right now with the Department of Human Services to have fentanyl test strips and training in all of our treatment providers that do treatment for drug court. So everybody that's getting drug treatment in Oklahoma County will be made aware of how and where to get test strips and Narcan. And so it'll be embedded in our treatment, or all of our treatment agencies will have testing strips and Narcan for free. And all of our participants will be educated on that, either for themselves or other people, you know, other people that they have that they're in relation to that might be addicted. Because not everybody needs a test strip is necessarily one who's using. It's just, you know, you have a loved one who's addicted, but they don't even have, they're so deep in their addiction, they don't have the wherewithal to always understand the risks. So we'll see how that goes. Like I said, we've just embarked on this. We have our first training in about 2 weeks on the fentanyl test strips, but we're making some inroads on that here in Oklahoma County.
That's great news. I think we firmly at OCGR believe, just like you said, education is important, but also just getting those resources in front of the right people is important. Letting people know their options, letting people know the education of all the people that are affected by the criminal legal system. Like you said, whether it's knowing a family member who is affected by the criminal legal system or addiction or even mental health. They all go hand in hand, unfortunately, and they exasperate each other. But with that, we will begin to close up. Thank you, everyone who watched along. I hope that if you do watch this episode, I hope you watch the mental health awareness episode as well, as there's ties, like we said, to a lot of these behaviors and a lot of these situations that unfortunately move from one issue to another. So say addiction may stem in some cases from mental health. And we try to dive into that a little bit more in that episode. But thank you everyone for watching. We hope you watch our other episodes, and we hope to see you back next week.